Chapter 15, A Matter of Brainwaves. Barbie, Jan, and Scotty were kind to Rick, which annoyed him considerably. If they had scolded him for bad judgment, called him a chucklehead, or even ignored him, that would have been all right. But they all had to reassure him and tell him that it could have happened to anybody, and so on, all of which made it unbearable. He was more sure than ever that the houseboaters and the barber were connected, but he still had no clear evidence. Of course, he made a report of the day's activity to Steve, who at least hadn't tried to be nice about it. "An agent can't always think of everything," was Steve's comment, "but he can try. Sometimes when he fails to take a factor into consideration, he gets away with it. Sometimes he fails. Sometimes he ends up dead because of his poor judgment. Just be glad your lives weren't hanging in the balance." Rick took the lesson to heart. He wouldn't make the same mistake twice. On the evening of the serial fiasco, Parnell Winston returned to Spindrift after another visit with Dr. Chavez. He called Steve Ames and spent a long time talking to the Yannick agent, and he called the project team and the boys into the library.
"We're on the track of something," he reported. "At least we think we are. It's so incredible, I can't simply believe it. If true, it means some unfriendly nation is so far ahead of us scientifically that we should be trembling in our boots."
Rick had realized that only agents of a hostile country could be involved in the actions against the project team. Everyone present had known as much, without a word being spoken. Only another country could gain from disruption of the project.
"Chavez and I have run a series of EEGs on Marks. We now have records of EEGs on the other two team members as well, and Steve has managed to turn up a pre-project EEG on one which gives us a basis of comparison. Now, to comprehend our tentative hypothesis, you must understand something of what is known about the brain."
Rick prepared to listen without much understanding. The field in which Parnell Winston worked was new and strange to him, and while he understood some of the basic theories, he got lost when Winston got highly technical.
"Our understanding of the human brain is very recent, and we're still only on the threshold of knowledge. In a way, we've just discovered the tools of research. The principal tool, of course, is electricity. Through it, we can explore the electrochemical nature of brain processes."
Rick was with him so far. He concentrated hard, not wanting to miss a thing.
"There's no point in reviewing the entire history of brain physiology. You all know Pavlov's work on conditioned reflexes. And you all know that Frisch and Hitzig demonstrated that when electrically stimulated, certain portions of the brain show a response. You also know that Caton discovered many years ago that the brain itself produces electric currents."
Rick hadn't known that, but he intended to find out. There had to be some of those works on brain physiology in the library.
"However, the important modern work started with Berger in the late 1920s. He found that the brain emits a definite pulse of activity, which is known as the Berger rhythm. Since then, Berger's work has been much refined. We now know that the brain actually produces a number of clearly defined electrical rhythms. These rhythms have been used in medical diagnosis of brain injury. Walter, in England, has even developed a machine that will show whether or not people will get along with each other by analysis of their wave patterns."
That was interesting, and Rick intended to find out more about it, but he began to wish that Winston would just come to the point.
"I might add that rhythmic brain patterns seem to be highly individual, no two alike, even in identical twins. However, each person shows a pattern that remains fairly constant, even over a period of years. With this background, you'll understand when I report that the EEGs taken of our colleagues' brains are completely abnormal. The EEGs were taken while they were awake, yet the most prominent pattern is the delta rhythm that is universally associated with sleep and some types of damage to the brain."
"Is there any other sign of physical damage?"
"No, the tests are all negative. Spinal taps show no concussion, and there's no evidence of trauma of any kind other than psychic. And yet, the delta rhythms persist. In one case, where we have an EEG taken before the incident, the pattern is completely different. The scientist had a pattern of a well-known type that bears no resemblance to the EEG taken after the incident.
Dr. Morrison leaned forward.
What is your conclusion? That our mysterious enemy has somehow caused damage of an unknown kind by remote means, and that can only mean one thing. The damage was caused electronically, probably by transmission through the air.
Why, that is incredible,
Weiss muttered, and the sentiment was reflected in the astonished gasps of the others.
Let's consider the implications of Parnell's statement, Hartzenbrandt said slowly. If he is correct, then the enemy has devised a means for causing brain disruption in an individual. A transmitted signal would inevitably strike countless others. There can be no such thing as a beam of radiation that strikes one person at a distance while missing all others. Therefore, this beam must affect only one person among many.
But how can a beam be tuned to one person, Dad? Rick asked.
I don't know, Rick. Hartzenbrandt turned to Winston. Do you?
Nay, I do not. I only have a hypothesis, and one so far afield from what we know of the brain today that I even hesitate to suggest it. Let me ask a question. If the enemy could have access to the brain pattern of an individual, and remember, such patterns are no more similar than fingerprints, could the enemy then transmit a signal that would affect only that one pattern?
Julius Weiss objected.
That supposition is based on scientific knowledge that does not even exist.
So far as we know, Dr. Morrison added.
Parnell Winston held up his hands.
I'm as aware as any of you that the hypothesis assumes a knowledge of the brain that is incredibly far advanced. But let's consider the evidence. The three scientists who have fallen victim show the same signs of brain damage. Investigation indicates they were different types who probably had dissimilar patterns. We also have the special case of Dr. Marks, who was drugged while on the train. The person who drugged him dropped soluble salt paste on the rug of his rooms. Can we accept the fact that the salt paste was used for EEG electrodes and a recording made while Marks was under the influence of the drug? We can't prove it, but what other explanation can there be?
Dr. Morrison shook his head.
Suppose we accept that theory. How does that account for the other two? They were under guard, and there's no evidence that they were ever drugged. If we accept your hypothesis, we must also accept the theory that the other two men somehow were given an EEG examination, and their patterns recorded.
An idea was growing in Rick's mind. Suddenly he blurted,
"That's where the barber comes in!"
The barber's machine was examined by Steve's men. They found it harmless, Hartzenbrandt pointed out. Scotty spoke up quickly.
Yeah, but when Duke looked at it this morning, he found electrical connections. Why couldn't an EEG be taken with such a gadget?
Parnell Winston considered.
I suppose it could, he said finally. I would need to examine the machine, but in theory, any gadget that fits over the head could be adapted for proper placement of electrodes. The recorder would be difficult to hide, unless it was in another room.
Rick sank back and looked at Scotty. No wonder the barber had wanted to give a treatment to Hartzenbrandt. The elevator operator's wink had told him that the scientist had been on the fourth floor where the project team was located.
Dr. Morrison, did you ever have your hair cut in the arcade shop? Rick asked.
No, Rick. I use the barber in the hotel nearby, the one I've patronized for years.
But the other two did use the shop in the building, Scotty finished, and Dr. Marks had no need for a barber, so they had to get him some other way.
Yes, that seems reasonable, Hartzenbrandt admitted. The pieces start to fall into place nicely, but we still have to first accept Parnell's theory that some kind of pattern can be transmitted that will interfere with normal brain activity. If we believe that, we must also believe that the enemy is so far ahead of us in brain physiology that we are hopelessly outdistanced. I can't believe so much progress could have taken place without some word of it leaking out.
Parnell Winston shrugged.
It seems incredible, Hartson, but we have another theory, much less a better one.
We had better make sure no one takes EEGs of the rest of us in any case,
Weiss suggested dryly.
Rick added,
and don't get any haircuts until this is all straightened out.
When the meeting broke up, Rick and Scotty walked to the front porch where the girls were listening to the music of a Newark disc jockey on Barbie's portable radio.
There's a lot of puzzled people in this neighborhood, Rick said, including me.
And me, Scotty agreed, and I'll bet I know the most curious one of all.
Who?
Cap'n Mike.
Rick grinned. At least the rest of them had some information. Even Duke and Jerry had enough to know that national security was somehow involved. But the captain, who had the liveliest curiosity of all, knew the least. As Rick dropped him off in front of the old windmill, Captain Mike had grunted,
"When you can trust me a little more, you might tell me what this is all about. Hey, boys."
Actually, Captain Mike's visit to the houseboat hadn't been particularly productive. He had little to add to the Coast Guard inspector's description, aside from his feeling that the houseboaters had wanted to get rid of him.
Scotty asked, "Why would anyone want to disrupt the brains of the project team? Seems to me that's the hard way of doing it. Assassination would be a lot easier."
Rick shook his head. He'd been wondering the same thing. Barbie and Jan motioned for silence. They were listening to a vocalist who happened to be Barbie's favorite at the moment. The boys stood silent for a few minutes, then by unspoken agreement turned and went back into the house. Harson Brandt came down the stairs dressed in a suit with a white shirt and tie. Rick stared at him.
"Are you going somewhere, Dad?"
"Yes. Parnell Winston has disturbed me deeply with the implications of his theory. I'm going to pay a call on an old friend in Newark, an associate of Chavez. I want to explore some of the electrophysiological background of his hypothesis. I won't be very late. Is there gas in the car?"
"It's almost full," Scotty said.
The boys went on upstairs into their adjoining rooms. For a few minutes, Rick tinkered with his camera equipment. Then he went back down to the library and searched the shelves for something to read. He finally settled on W. Gray Walter's The Living Brain and carried it back up to his room. He sat down in the old leather armchair and manipulated buttons on one arm. The light brightened to reading intensity, and the back tilted to the most comfortable position. He had wired the chair himself, and it fit him perfectly. He settled down to read. Time passed as he lost himself in the clear, exciting descriptions of Dr. Walter's book. He heard the phone ring downstairs, but paid no attention. Then Scotty stuck his head in the door.
"Rick, your mother's calling you."
Rick sat up swiftly. It was true. His mother had urgency in her voice. He dropped the book and ran to the stairs, going down them three at a time. A strange, dark-haired man was standing in the hallway, and his mother, Barbie, and Jan were waiting for him with strained white faces.
"Your father has been hurt,"
Mrs. Brandt said with false calm.
"He's on this gentleman's houseboat.